This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name's Eamon Flack. I'm the artistic director here at Belvoir. This is the very first of these Monday conversations. We're going to begin each week with, we think, with an actor, because that's what Belvoir offers to these conversations. And then we'll kick off. So this is for Sir Thomas Browne, who lived in the 17th century. He was a writer and a thinker and something of a scientist. You'll notice as the night progresses that science has changed a bit since Thomas Browne wrote this. Half our days we pass in the shadow of the earth, and the brother of death exacteth a third part of our lives. A good part of our sleep is pieced out with visions and fantastical objects wherein we are confessedly deceived. The day supplies us with truths, the night with fictions and falsehoods which uncomfortably divide the natural account of our beings. And therefore, having passed the day in sober labours and rational inquiries of truth, we are fain to betake ourselves unto such a state of being wherein the soberest heads have acted all the monstrosities of melancholy, and which under open eyes are no better than folly and madness. Happy are they that go to bed with grave music like Pythagoras, or have ways to compose the fantastical spirit whose unruly wanderings takes of inward sleep. Virtuous thoughts of the day lay up good treasons for the night, whereby the impressions on imaginary of forms arise into sober similitudes, acceptable unto our slumbering selves, and preparatory unto divine impressions. Hereby Solomon's sleep was happy. That there should be divine dreams seems unreasonably doubted by Aristotle. That there are demonical dreams, we have little reason to doubt. Why may there not be angelical? If there be guardian spirits, they may not be unactively about us in sleep, but may sometimes order our dreams, and many strange hints, instigations, or discoveries which are so amazing to us may arise from such foundations. But the phantasms of sleep do commonly walk in the great road of natural and animal dreams, wherein the thoughts or actions of the day are acted over and echoed in the night. Who can therefore wonder that Cardan, whose head was so taken up about the stars, should dream that his soul was in the moon? To add unto the delusions of dreams, the fantastical objects seem greater than they are, and being beheld to the vaporous state of sleep, enlarge their diameters unto us, whereby it may prove more easy to dream of giants than pygmies. Helmont himself might dream himself a bubble extending unto the eighth sphere. A little water makes a sea, a small puff of wind, a tempest. But beside these innocent delusions, there is a sinful state of dreams. Death alone, not sleep, is able to put an end unto sin, and there may be a night book of our iniquities. If some have swooned, they may also have died in dreams, since death is but a confirmed swounding. Whether Plato died in a dream, as some deliver, he must rise again to inform us.
Eamon Flack, everyone. I'm glad that Eamon has warmed us up for a conversation about dreams and vapours and sleep, because that's what we're going to be doing for the next 50 or so minutes. But g'day, and welcome to Monday Conversations, presented to you by the Wheeler Centre, the Sydney Writers' Festival, and of course, Belvoir. My name's Benjamin Law. On behalf of the event, I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we're gathered. And here in central Sydney, south of the bridge, that's the Gadigal of the Eora Nations. The Gadigal, like all First Nation Australians, have storytelling traditions that span millennia. And we are very lucky and very grateful to elders past and present that we can continue telling stories here on what is and what always will be Aboriginal land. So Monday Conversations is a new monthly chat where we get to focus on and explore one idea or topic that really captivates us. And tonight we're looking at something most of us will probably experience at some stage in our lives: general anaesthetic or anaesthesia. In her new book, Anaesthesia, The Gift of Oblivion and the Mystery of Consciousness, journalist Kate Cole Adams looks at the facts and explores the enigma of this mysterious medical practice in what is part science book, part memoir and also occasionally veers into horror. In it, she asks, how common is it for patients to wake up during surgery? And is pain still pain if you can't remember the pain afterwards? And what is anesthesia anyway? And I guess that asks another question, which is, what is consciousness anyway? After her book was recently published, Kate was interviewed on ABC RN's Life Matters, and one of the listeners who responded publicly and positively to that interview on Facebook was specialist anaesthetist Dr. Tim McCulloch from Sydney's Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, who is also a lecturer at the University of Sydney. Tonight, Monday Conversations brings both author and anaesthetist together. Please make them feel welcome. Kate, hello. I'm going to start with you. As I mentioned, this book can veer into some case studies that read like horror stories sometimes. Yeah. One of the stories that captivates you early on is about someone called Rachel. Who is Rachel and what happened to her?
Basically, Rachel is a woman I met at a dinner party in Katoomba in the Blue Mountains. And it was a group of women and we were sort of having what seemed like a perfectly pleasant dinner party until somewhere between the first course and the second, Rachel started telling us about the birth of her daughter. And the story was so shocking. I had never heard of anything happening like this before. And basically, Rachel's story was that she woke up, she had to have an emergency caesar under a general anaesthetic, and she woke up at the first incision and was basically awake throughout the operation, and she could feel everything, but she couldn't move. So I'm sort of getting that out of the way. We're getting that out of the way now, so that everyone can go, oh, my God, because it does happen sometimes. Mm. But I was so sort of, you know, that was what started me, because I thought, how can this even exist? But, in fact, and what I realised later was that I'd actually had a preoccupation with the sort of idea of sort of paralysis and unconscious states for much longer. And I looked back quite recently and realised, you know, I'd done articles on locked-in syndrome and I'd done, you know, all sorts of things. So I think, you know, I've been carrying that idea around.
You're a novelist as well, and the novel in part looks at someone who's recovering from a coma as well, these liminal states of consciousness and unconsciousness.
Yeah, who's married to an anaesthetist.
And so... there's a theme in your work here.
There is.
Looking back, I mean, this is something that you've now realised about you and your work. Can you articulate what you suspect that preoccupation is about, or why you are especially fascinated with those states?
Well, I'll sort of start with no, and then I'll go into all of the possibilities. Mm. I think that, well, I feel like I should stick with no.
Welcome to the therapist couch,
yes,
Kate.
Thank you. I am very interested in the sort of personal unconscious, mainly because I've kind of spent years trying to avoid my own and have realised that it keeps on kind of coming and biting me anyway. And I think somewhere in the whole conversation about and sort of starting to investigate anaesthesia and sort of starting off looking at these cases where people are actually awake, which are rare but can be traumatic, what I sort of veered into was this whole other area, which to me was really fascinating, about, well, what if you're actually unconscious, but... like, what does that actually mean? And can you still learn things when you're unconscious? Which is yes. And and I think for me, somewhere in that whole process, there's an exploration of the kind of crossover or sort of, you know, you said liminal zone before, that between what is, you know, called the anaesthetic unconscious, which sounds very medical and precise, and the, you know, what would be called the, you know, psychoanalytic unconscious, which sounds very kind of Freudian and imprecise and, you know, possibly not even proper these days. Mm. But that messy terrain is what interests me.
And it also sounds like you're tapping into a state of terror as well. I mean, the idea of something happening to you, something painful happening to you, and you not being able to tell people, that's being operated on without anaesthetic, or the anaesthetic not working. It's also locked-in syndrome and to a point coma as well. Mm-hmm. When you write about the story of Rachel, I'll pass it on to you, Tim. We read about that and we think, oh my God, that sounds like a experience of torture. Tim, as an anaesthetist, how common is that and why does it happen?
So one of the terms for it is accidental awareness under intended general anaesthesia. So,
right, write that down.
So the idea is our aim is to render someone unconscious and in a special sort of way and unrousably unconscious. Nothing that happens to that person when they're under a proper general anaesthetic can bring back awareness, consciousness. So that's what we're aiming for. But sometimes accidental awareness is essentially a failure to deliver the drugs that ensure unconsciousness. So for whatever reason, the person is conscious. How common is it? I think that was the question. Mm-hmm. So it depends a bit on how you go about trying to find out. If you go to every person after a general anaesthetic, immediately after waking up and say, do you remember anything? And then ask them again the next day and then again 2 or 3 days later. Mm. Some people will remember something at one of those interviews but not have remembered it before and then forgotten it again. So if you ask them that many times, you'll get about 1 in 1,000 standard general anaesthetics. Somebody will remember something, about 1 in 1,000.
When you describe it as a failure, what accounts for that failure? Is it human error or is it because, as Kate suggests in her book, it's an inexact science?
Both. Mm-hmm. It's definitely an inexact science. But then again, so is much of medicine. We talk about bell curves and different responses of different people. And so because it's such a bad thing to happen, what we try to do is err on the side of safety and give everyone enough drug to make sure that they're unconscious, which means you're giving most people more than they need, a relative overdose for most people, just so that you can be sure that as close as possible to 100% are unconscious. But then some people are sick and they can't tolerate that amount. You mentioned cesarean sections. Sometimes the baby's sick or the general anaesthetic, we're worried will affect the baby. So until the baby's out, we are taught to hold back on the doses as much as possible. And you can overdo that. In previous times, there were different anaesthetic techniques, which we now know had a very high risk of awareness.
Mm.
Sometimes it can be equipment error because there's bits of equipment that we use to deliver the drugs.
Mm.
And sometimes it can be, yes, human error. The drug can run out and you don't notice.
Mm. Well, Tim, I mean, you talk about the history and evolution of anaesthesia. You discuss this in your book as well, Kate. So until the middle 1800s, general anaesthesia wasn't a thing. It didn't exist. So what did we do back then?
Well, you know, basically we... pretty well tied people to... I mean, there weren't many operations to start with.
Mm.
And, I mean, there are, you know, Tim, I mean, you'd be... there are a whole lot of accounts of, you know, people being tied to tables, screaming. There are accounts of people actually getting off the tables and trying to run away down corridors.
Wow. Just, like, cut open, their guts spilling out or something.
Well, you know, stuff happening.
Sorry, my imagination is running wild now.
No, I know.
But the main quality a surgeon had to have in those days was speed.
Yeah.
And maybe a large net.
Right.
Yeah.
But really, there were hardly any operations. I mean, because most people would understandably think twice about, you know, how desperate. And a lot of people would just die.
Rather than undergo surgery.
Mm. Although, I mean, interestingly, there were people who were actually doing... I mean, everyone's probably heard of the term mesmerism and Anton Mesmer, who although he was a kind of a bit out there with some of his theories, but he was basically hypnotising people. And I think there was a... Who was the Scottish surgeon? Huey or someone. And he went to Bengal and he's sort of following on from Mesmer. He operated on a lot of people really successfully using hypnosis and nothing but hypnosis. And that still happens occasionally today. I mean, you know, it's weird, but... And what's that about? What's that about?
I've no idea.
I mean, hypnosis does...
It's much easier to give drugs.
Hypnosis does come up in the book. There are case studies where people go through surgery under general anaesthetic and then under hypnosis might recall things. I mean, when you ask what is that about, what do you suspect? What are your hunches when you did your research for this book? And what were those case studies like?
I'll start with the last bit because that's easiest.
Mm.
There was a very famous or sort of, well, maybe not so famous, but there was a study in the 60s, which is a sort of seminal study, which I kind of talk about as the unrepeatable study, because once it was done, you could never kind of ethically repeat it, where a South African psychiatrist called Bernard Levinson basically talked a dental surgeon into allowing him to sort of do this unofficial experiment on his patients. And just before the patients... after the patients were under and halfway through the operation, they would stop the operation and the anaesthetist would read this prepared script, which basically said, oh, the patient's looking very blue, I don't like the patient's colour, quick, pump the breathing bag. And then they'd actually do breathing bag noises just to make it seem authentic. And then he'd say, oh, it's all right, they're looking great now, it's all good. So, and then after the operation, when the patients wake up, they say, you know, how was it? What was the last thing you remember? And they're like, oh, it was fine. I remember, you know, being in the room before I went in. A month later, Levinson hypnotised them. And under hypnosis, half of those people remembered verbatim part of the crisis script. So that was a very fascinating and very flawed study, and there was so much about that study that was wrong, and you know.
When you say unrepeatable, would not get past an ethics committee nowadays.
Well, you couldn't. The problem with it was, although it sort of failed in, you know, there wasn't a control group, there were various other things, because he had such powerful reactions. You actually can't. I mean, of course, it does happen in surgery every day, which is kind of like a natural experiment, but you're not allowed to deliberately say things like that to patients in an experimental situation. Mm. So these days they keep trying to, or occasionally sort of try and experiment with that stuff, but instead of saying things like, oh, my God, the patient's looking really blue, they say things like orange, pear.
Mm. And so now, having looked at that case study, and that kind of informs a lot of, you know, the questions that are asked in the book, what are your hunches? How do you account for something like that? I'd like both of your responses, actually. But as a writer, having interrogated this for a while, what have you landed on?
Look, I think for me, my sense is, and I'll just say quickly, I mean, the thing about that particular experiment was it was also done under ether, which isn't a drug that's used anymore. But, you know, there are more recent, there are anecdotal stories about people waking up and either being very distressed or not healing well, and then again under hypnosis recalling things that were said. And there's a sort of famous study where a woman, you know, she, after her you know, she became quite suicidal, and she went to see the psychiatrist, and under hypnosis she remembered someone saying, oh, you know, she really is fat, isn't she? And he verified that. He went and checked with the surgeon, and the surgeon said, well, yeah, I did say that. And actually, it sounds like a terrible thing to say, but weight does make a difference, doesn't it, when you're anaesthetising someone?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's one of the more difficult things, is very overweight people, more risky to anaesthetise, and you have to get special equipment into the room and all sorts of things.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, Ben, just finishing off that question, you know, to me that question about, well, at what point does the sort of anaesthetic unconscious, and even if it's sort of, you know, just a light anaesthetic, at what point does that start potentially to kind of drift into other parts of our psyche? My sense is that it can in some situations. I don't know how often. But it kind of fascinates me because, you know, the thing about unconscious things that we hold unconsciously is they're actually much harder to make decisions about or to act consciously on, because we don't actually know it's happening. So I'm kind of a bit preoccupied with that.
Tim, when you hear about the unrepeatable experiment, you know, definitely unethical by today's standards, we can't repeat it either, maybe not representative in terms of numbers, and yet, you know, I think just even hearing that people can recall things during surgery is quite a haunting concept. When you hear something like that, what are your thoughts?
Well, I was actually, because of reading the book, was driven to look up some of those stories, and it was quite a flawed experiment, but that's, be that as it may, the general question, I suppose, is if a patient has anaesthetic drugs on board and they're unconscious, they're not responding to anything, they're actually tolerating somebody cutting into their body and sawing their bones or whatever. So clearly they don't seem to be responding to what's happening around them. And yet, could it be possible that they are subconsciously or unconsciously taking in information in one way or another. Mm. Maybe the pain of the surgery, in inverted commas, is causing changes in them. Or maybe even the things that are being said in the operating theatre. Who's to say that's not possible? Mm.
And in your professional work as an anaesthetist, does that kind of story reflect any of your patients' experiences at all?
No.
I mean, it's under ether. Like you say, it's not something we use anymore. Does that happen in modern anaesthetic techniques?
Well, lots of things happen. Towards the end of the surgery, for instance, we start turning down the dose of the anaesthetic and then the person wakes up, and often they'll start responding and yet not remember those responses later. So you become responsive and to the environment and to other people around you before you start taking in explicit memories. Mm. So, yes, people have memories of various things, but I've not personally had patients who've told me stories that make me think they were somehow affected or traumatised by what was happening during the surgery. What it does make, I think we're a lot more careful about what we say in the operating theatre when someone's under anaesthetic than maybe we used to be, and I mm-hmm. think the public awareness of these sort of things has made us think, well, hang on, maybe it isn't the best. But there's all sorts of implications, because it's not just talking about the patient. Often we're talking about the next patient on the operating theatre or the sick patient from yesterday, and I was thinking about, so what's the ethics of that? Because normally you wouldn't talk about that in the presence of a...
That's right.
Are we breaking confidentiality by talking about you while I've got another patient anaesthetised?
Mm-hmm. Also that idea that if even a semi-conscious patient is kind of hearing in anything, basically you're so sort of vulnerable at that point, and you're psychologically vulnerable because, you know, the parts of yourself that are equipped to kind of contextualise and sort of look at something in a sort of look at the bigger picture, they're pretty well knocked out still. So I think people, you know, to the extent that people do take in information, it can be very, very literal.
Mm.
And, you know, there was one story that I was told by a medical psychologist in the US about a patient. And again, this was like in the 80s, so a lot of stuff seemed to go down in the 80s. But you know, and it's not
it.
But he had a story. A woman had rung him up with a story about going to have surgery to have cancer removed, and afterwards the surgeon saying, yes, it's, you know, that all went really, really well and that was all great. And then she went home and she just said that she just felt really wrong, and she felt really wrong, and she kept on thinking, yeah, but I'm going to die. And she went back to the surgeon and he said, no, really, you're looking pretty good. He said, maybe go and see a psychiatrist. She saw a psychiatrist. This went on for a while. And eventually, and nothing helped, and eventually she went back to the surgeon and he said, look, you're fine. And she just burst out and she said, but you didn't get rid of the black stuff. And there was this pause and the surgeon said, oh, my God. And then he explained to her that, right, and it was the end of the operation. It was the part where they were sewing up, and so everyone was a bit more relaxed and everyone just started talking about a whole lot of shit, really. And he started talking about the grout, the mould on the grout in his bathroom. And she had taken that in, and she thought that it was her, and she thought she was dying. And so I think that there's that, you know, to me a lot of these conversations are about vulnerability.
What are we supposed to take from that story, besides the fact that grout is disgusting and very triggering? But what is happening there? You know, like, it doesn't sound like she was necessarily aware of where her distress stemmed from until this moment where the dams kind of broke and everything kind of flowed out of her. What do we think is going on there?
Well, that whole, you mentioned the Freudian idea of the subconscious. So I think the concept most of us have these days is that our consciousness, the story we're telling ourselves as we go from moment to moment, is a very superficial thing, really, and there's a whole lot of stuff going on deep to that, and a whole lot of memories that we don't have access to anyway. I mean, childhood memories, so... it sounds like, yeah, exactly what you said. She's taken in this information that's affecting her in a process that she's not consciously aware of until suddenly dawned on her. Because I gather from that story she hadn't remembered that black stuff words until that moment.
No, she didn't remember anything. She just thought that she was dying, you know, and that, yeah, so...
And so there are some fundamental mysteries about consciousness and unconsciousness and what's happening with our brains during anaesthetic. And because of that, you're saying that surgeons and anaesthetists will be more careful about what they say to accommodate for that fundamental mystery, essentially. So Tim, can we stay with you? So several years ago, smashed my elbow very badly. I was running for a plane. Don't do that if you don't have grip on your shoes. And this just shattered, right? I was rushed off to a hospital in Melbourne, and then they told me that this was all busted up and I was about to go under general anaesthetic and they needed to repair it. This is my first time under general. I go out and then I come back what seems like immediately. I think that's an experience that a lot of people have with general anaesthetic, this idea that time hasn't even passed whatsoever. And it was kind of like fascinating but disconcerting. Behind the scenes, can you actually lead us? What happened to me? What goes on? What's administered to us when we go through general anaesthetic?
Well, you want some details?
Okay. And how much of it is pain relief? How much of it is blocking out our consciousness? How much of it is obliterating our memory? What's going on?
Okay, well, well, these days often the first thing, the nurse would have spoken to you and got a medical history and everything. You would have had a cannula inserted at some point, and they may well have given you a drug called midazolam, very commonly used these days, which is like Valium, it's a benzodiazepine, and it's very good at stopping you remembering things. And so after that midazolam, you may have well still been, you may have gone quite sleepy, or you may have been quite still responsive. You may have even had some quite long and detailed conversations.
Oh, Jesus.
Exactly. And some people actually find that idea more distressing than the general anaesthesia. Yeah.
The idea people of anaesthetic as a truth serum or something.
Yeah, well, what could I have said? What do you mean? I told you stuff that I don't remember doing that. So some people find that concept very worrying. And then you would have been taken into an operating theatre and we would have connected you to various monitors to check that things are safe, check the oxygen in your blood's the big one we care about. And then we would have given you a stronger hypnotic drug, we call it, to make you completely unconscious. And that could have been either injection or breathing a gas, or commonly starting with an injection, then switching to a gas after you're asleep. If it was within a short period of time after the trauma, after the accident, then we would have been worried that your stomach might have had stuff in it still, because trauma and the pain relief you would have been given, that can slow down the emptying of the stomach. So even though you may have been fasting for the anaesthetic, we may have been nervous that as soon as you're unconscious, you could have regurgitated stuff and it could get into your lungs. Oh. So we really worry about that. So we might have immediately after putting you to sleep given you a drug to paralyse you so you don't move, and then put a breathing tube into your windpipe through your vocal cords, which are important for your profession. So here we are putting big pieces of plastic around there. And after that, we would have kept you unconscious for however long it took, and then stopped administering those drugs. Your body would have eliminated them and you would have woken up again. Now, as far as pain, people vary a lot in how much drug we give to specifically block the pain pathways. You can't actually have pain technically while you're unconscious, because pain is an experience. It's an unpleasant emotional experience. And when you're unconscious, by definition, you're not having any experiences. But your body still responds to the cutting and the pulling on the fracture and all of that. So we do give some drugs, partly so that they'll hang over when you first wake up, so you're not in too much agony when you first wake up. Mm. Sounds like you weren't, because... Yeah.
Don't remember anything.
Right.
Unless I do. But as you go through that, it really sounds like a really interesting and quite complicated cocktail of things that are going into our body. And one of the ingredients in that cocktail is to make us forget. Maybe I'll throw it open to both of you. Why is that important? What do we need to forget?
Well, in terms of just rendering you unconscious so that you can tolerate the whole procedure, you forget because you're not experiencing it, so there's nothing to forget. That's the simplistic way of thinking about it. As far as your consciousness is concerned, it never happened. For the anxiety procedure, the anxiety that a lot of people experience just before and just after, then we can give these anxiolytics, which also have a side effect of causing you not to remember. Sometimes people are suffering at the time and don't remember. That's an interesting question. Is that... Is that all right?
It's a very kind of eternal sunshine of the spotless mind scenario going on.
It is.
On
There's
here,
a
right?
lot of eternal sunshine. Yeah.
What do you think? And is it okay if you tell me you're suffering, but I'll say it's okay because you won't remember it later?
I would say personally and philosophically I'm not with that. And in fact, there was a group of... I mean, this conversation has been going on, you know, among small groups of anaesthetists who kind of, I suspect, don't talk to their colleagues a lot about it. But there was a group of anaesthetists in England, and an American anaesthetist had actually asked the question, when people are unconscious, do we actually want them? You know, I mean, anaesthetists don't... I mean, I say broadly anaesthetists, but from my understanding, don't actually even agree on exactly what anaesthesia should do. And certainly this guy, Bob Vesalius, he sort of said, well, look, should we be looking at an anaesthetic to take away consciousness, or is what we need it to take away memory? And basically his argument was taking away, like being absolutely certain of taking away consciousness means that you're overdosing, as you said, Tim, and that there are actually problems with overdosing as well. But anyway, there was a response from a team in England who basically did a quick survey among their mob, and you know, would you be happy to be you know awake and in pain without remembering it, and sort of various iterations of that, and they were pretty resounding. It was like 97% were like, no,
that's not okay.
You know, that is not okay. And also, I think it's actually, I mean, I think there's that whole conversation about, well, if you've actually got you know, if your body's actually experiencing uncontrolled, whether you call it pain or nociception or whatever, during an operation, you're actually increasing the risk that they're going to go on and have some kind of, you know, potentially problems with chronic pain afterwards. Mm. Because even if you're not remembering, even if your mind's not remembering, your body remembers stuff. And that's a whole other conversation, which would be a whole other book or several. Maybe you could do that one.
Well, the spinal cord can remember.
Yeah.
By having intense painful stimulation, there's some evidence that the nerves in the spinal cord that carry the pain information, they wind up and they get out of control, and then you might be more likely to have chronic pain afterwards. But it's hard to get a thing. You haven't got proof that what we do under general anaesthesia does make a difference in the long run in that respect.
No, I know. Oh, but I think one of the things that fascinated me in starting to research what I thought would be a fairly contained 2-year project...
How many years ago was
that? Like 15.
You had to bring it up.
Was realising that really very quickly in kind of my exploration, you kind of went through pharmacology and neurology, and suddenly, whammo, you're in philosophy and you're in ethics, and it's so quick. And that was what really... And, you know, that was around the time when I started thinking, oh, I think there's a book in this. It's like really, like, because it's so... interesting, because we just don't know. And those questions about, you know, is it okay to be in pain and not know you're in pain, it's sort of like, well, it depends which version of you is answering it. And you can say, well, physiologically, yeah, there's problems with it, but also it's like, well, even if there aren't, is that okay? I don't know. I mean, what do people out here think? Would you be happy with being in pain even if you didn't remember it afterwards?
Provided you don't remember it tomorrow.
Provided
is it okay being in pain now? I mean, I
no.
think...
I mean, you...
Isn't
you...
our job to relieve human suffering? And if you take it to the logical extreme, none of the pain we experience this week will be remembered in 1,000 years' time by anybody. So therefore it doesn't matter. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me. So.
But that's history, isn't it?
You give a very extreme example of how there was a long period of human history where it was considered acceptable to operate on newborns without anaesthetic because they would not remember the pain, essentially. I mean, that's kind of the territory we're entering into when we have that discussion about whether remembering pain cancels out, like forgetting pain cancels out the pain itself.
Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, Tim would probably be more equipped to answer that, but certainly my understanding was that sort of until the 70s, and I think one of the problems is that actually anaesthetics aren't good, and especially, you know, anaesthetics have got better and better, but, you know, anaesthetics aren't great for babies either, so there was this notion, I mean, that... You know, I was reading quite a lot of stuff about how newborns, they wouldn't use anaesthesia. anaesthetic.
Well, this is what do you call them? Circumcisions. That was commonly performed. The rationale was not just that they don't remember, it was also their nervous system is immature, so therefore they're not really experiencing the pain.
Yeah.
Mm. That was part of the rationale.
Wow. Yeah. And was there any science to actually prove their hunch, or were they just saying, we reckon it's immature?
Well, it is immature, that's true. But,
right.
Yeah, things like people measured blood hormone levels and cortisol and stress hormones went screaming high in the newborns. So they thought, well, maybe that's not a good idea.
Kate, you did mention that this book, from when you conceived it to it coming out now, was a process that took over a decade, essentially. You started with this idea, it's mainly going to be a self-contained book about anaesthetics, but then you realise there are deeper kind of philosophical questions, almost riddles, about all these other things, like what is consciousness? I mean, in all of this, even though we're talking about anaesthesia, aren't we kind of having a much broader conversation about what is alive, what is awake and what is sleep? Does this also reveal the extent to which we as humans and the medical profession know so little about what these things and what these states actually are as well?
Well, I mean, consciousness studies is, I think there's been a resurgence in popularity in consciousness studies. It was kind of completely out of fashion for quite a while, but people certainly don't agree on what consciousness is. So we've got this science which, seems to work pretty well most of the time, but which takes away something which no one can really agree on what it is, and which is, arguably completely indefinable anyway, that we may never know what it is, so we may never know what it is we're taking away, or if indeed we're taking it away, or what taking it away even means, because what's left over when you take away what you don't even know what it is?
Are we even here right now?
Well, that's right.
Back to the spot was mined.
Yeah. I mean, are these conversations that anaesthetists have amongst themselves?
Not on a day-to-day basis.
No, not in the lunchroom.
I mean, you're almost flattering us by calling it a science.
That is a scary sentence. what do you mean by that?
Well, we're very careful about looking at our results, and we know that it works. People get through surgery and they're very happy to come back for more surgery. But we talked about the origin of anaesthesia, and no one sat down and said, oh, well, okay, we need to take away consciousness, therefore then people can get through surgery. So, okay, what's consciousness? It's this, and how is it happening? Well, it's this bit of the brain. So if we designed, it was none of that. It was just playing around with new molecules and nitrous oxide. Mm. Someone discovered that and thought, what's it like to breathe it? Oh, that's bad.
It was a recreation. It started with party drugs, basically. It started with recreational drugs. Ether parties and nitrous parties.
And people noticed that they would wake up with all these bruises, and I don't remember bashing my leg and I didn't feel a thing at the time, and they were partially anaesthetised. Yeah. It's all very empirical, if you like. It's just trying things out and they just work.
When you're talking about trying things out, to what extent is it still very much evolving now? For instance, how long have you been an anaesthetist now?
I started training in the mid-90s.
And has approaches or ways that we think about anaesthetic changed from when you started to now?
Lots of things have changed. A lot of it's to do with our monitoring, our measuring devices, and that's made it much safer. I mean, I think you were alluding to the babies for circumcisions. It might have seemed too risky to give a general anaesthetic back in those days because it was risky. And nowadays it's almost, it's very safe. So that's definitely improved. The drugs have changed a little bit. We're using different sort of recipes. We've got some newer drugs which... one of the best things is they wear off really, really quickly. So we can give quite intense high doses of certain drugs and then turn them off and they're eliminated very quickly, which is handy. Mm. Makes it much easier to judge things and to keep it safe.
Yeah. Are there any kinks that need to be ironed out? Like, what's the next frontier? What would be like a eureka moment if we were heading towards one with anaesthetics?
So the drugs do have side effects and they suppress the heart, and in sick elderly people, we're operating more and more older and older and sicker people. So it'd be nice to have drugs that didn't have those side effects. It'd be nice just to have a helmet you put on and turn a switch, unconscious. That would be great. I guess a lot of the work these days is on what we call perioperative medicine, which is looking after the patient you know, before and after the actual surgery itself, because, as I say, things have got... I reckon we're pretty good in the operating theatre now.
Kate, when you were researching and writing this book as well, as much as it is a science book, it's a personal book as well. You share a lot with us in terms of medicine and family background as well. And a part of that personal experience is you're about to face major surgery, and you mentioned that quite early on in the book as well. And then you sort of say to, I think it's a nurse, I may know too much now. Can you share with us a bit about that situation and experience and how it informed your book?
Well, I mean, I started, in fact, about 5 years into the endless, well, not endless actually, into that long research process, I discovered that I was going to have major surgery. I had a condition called scoliosis, and so my spine was getting more and more and more bent, and I kept on trying to think it straight, but it didn't work. So, I've forgotten your question.
Oh, well, and well, what happened next?
Well, I had the surgery.
Okay,
basically.
But going into were you?
Well, I was really... I basically used it because I was already so kind of sort of... enmeshed in the process. I can remember, you know, the day I realised I would have to have the surgery, and I was deeply distressed and I was terribly upset, and I said to my partner, oh my God, I'm going to have an operation. And then I thought, in the back of my mind, I thought, okay, now I know how I'm going to structure the book. I was like, okay, I will use it for good. So the book now starts with me going under and ends with me,
recovering.
Yeah. But I did then get to actually use myself as a bit of an unrepeatable experiment because, I sort of went and some of these people I'd been talking to about some of the research they'd done, and there was this one guy, Hank Bennett, who, you know, he had a theory that actually, you know, maybe the thing about anaesthesia was that although people tended to be very passive, patients tend to be passive, that maybe we should see it as a more active process and that maybe we'd come out of it better if we saw it less like a lie down and more like a marathon.
Mm.
And so he actually did some experiments, including one where he instructed patients with through a sort of hypnotic suggestion, but he instructed patients before surgery to sort of do various things, but the thing that really struck me was that he instructed them to, at the incision, to draw the blood away from the wound site and to keep it away until after they'd been stitched up, and then to bring the blood back to help it heal. And that was such a nutty idea, really. It was like, what is that even about? But this experiment, which was a small experiment, but it showed a really significant reduction in blood loss. And as it happened, these were in people having spinal surgery. And I have actually seen more recent studies. So many of these studies, some of them get replicated successfully, some of them don't. And this study has been replicated both unsuccessfully and successfully. But I kind of, feeling fairly desperate before I went in, I thought, okay, I'm going to use, you know, and so I contacted him and I said, do you have that tape? Can I use it? And so I spent about, you know, 10 days before I went into surgery, you know, lying in bed listening to this kind of some sort of fairly bad 80s music. But but also, you know, Hank just talking in this very circular way about moving blood away from my back. And I was too scared to tell my surgeon or indeed my anaesthetist. That was what I was doing because I thought they'd think I was a complete nutter. So I didn't mention anything. But after the surgery, when I in fact was alive, which was great,
we're grateful too.
I asked my surgeon in a very casual sort of way, and I sort of said, "Oh, well, you know, did I lose much blood?" And he said, well, actually, surprisingly little. And I'd actually lost less blood than the people in the Hank Bennett study, significantly less than them. So, I mean, that might be about techniques as well.
Our surgeons are better than the Americans.
Well, they probably are. But anyway, look, you know, who knows what that means. That could mean various things. But I kind of found it fascinating and I was quite pleased.
One of the recurring themes is about how much information is too much. I mean, when you go into your surgery, you're like, I think I know too much about anaesthetics now, and depending on the patient, I guess, but often if we know more about what's going to happen to us, the more soothed we are. I mean, in your experience when talking to patients who have anxiety about going under general, how do you How do you discuss it? And is there such thing as giving them too much information about what they're about to undergo?
Yeah, it's so variable. I do a regular pre-admission clinic, we call it, and we meet the patients for the first time. Usually it's not even me that's going to be giving the patients I meet the anaesthetic, or you know, it's someone else. So, and there's so much going on for them, and they've just seen the nurse who's given them all the information about whatever post-operative bits and pieces they're going to have to deal with, and they might, some often fresh from the surgeon who's just dropped the bombshell that they should have this major operation, and it's kind of, it's all very rushed, and you have to make a quick assessment, but there are definitely some people that's just, and the other thing to remember, just in terms of this, like we talk about the consent process and informed consent, and the patient should know what they're getting in for, and they should know any risks. But as I said before, for most patients having important surgery, the risk of the surgery is so much more than the risk of the anaesthetic that becomes a bit of a moot point. So I just sort of try to feel it out. And if the patient's asking questions or I start offering information, and often the patients will just pull back and they don't want to know all about the bits and pieces that I'm going to put into their body after they're unconscious or whatever. They just get on with it. And then the occasional patient will want to know everything.
I spoke to a friend of mine yesterday who I hadn't seen for ages, and she came up and gave me a kiss and she said, "I've got your book and I'm not going to read it." So I'm just saying that now so it's out in the open. And, you know, and I mean, my feeling is I have people coming
Because she was about to have surgery, or is that what you mean?
No, just because she said, "I don't want to know." She said, "I don't want to know," and she said, "I might have surgery and it'll freak me out." And I think, you know, and I mean, for me it's been one of the you know, just sort of trying to get that balance right, because I mean, I suppose partly, yes, I'm the sort of person who's, you know, lying on the table and they're, you know, someone like you is pumping in drugs, and I'm saying, "Now, what's that one? What's that? What's that?"
How many milligrams per kilogram are you?
But, you know, one of the things I found really fascinating in the research, I mean, because I had this notion that we kind of see as patients, and I'm not sure about it, from your perspective, we see anaesthetic and anaesthesia as this kind of this blank nothingness. It's just like you sort of run into a wall and then you kind of emerge on the other side of the wall, and it's like, and you know, and I suppose what fascinates me is, well, you know, what kind of happens in the middle there? I guess that's been a lot of my preoccupation. I was going to say something else, but it's
Can I stay with you, Kate? You mentioned that's one reader response to the book. I've bought your book and I'm not going to read it. I mean, that's sad, but you still retain royalty, so whatever. But now that the book has been out in the world for a little bit, what have readers been telling you? What has their feedback and response been to your book, and has it surprised you?
I've been... to start with, I was very nervous about the responses from the medical and anaesthesia community, even though I'd had a senior anaesthetist read through the book and sort of give it a thumbs up. I was still pretty nervous, and so, you know, when someone rang me up and said, "Oh, there's this anaesthetist on the radio talking about your book," and I was like, "No." But I've actually been really... I've had a lot of really positive response from anaesthetists from all over the world. And so, I kind of wondered whether it was partly because anaesthetists are going, "Hooray, someone's just noticing us now," because...
Is that what you people want, attention?
But it's also generally not.
Anaesthetic, it's a weird job.
And you do a weird job where you take away people's consciousness and memory, including half the time of you... And so they come out and they go, "Hooray, the surgeon!" And it's like, but hey, I was keeping you alive. I don't know. I mean, does that?
Well, this is a very weird experience for me. I've never done anything like this before. So, and your books obviously caused that to happen.
None of you will remember it.
All the suffering and pain you're going through. we think about the personalities of people that go into anaesthesia, and kind of if you want lots of accolades and thanks from people, then anaesthetic's not the profession to go into. And it's very easy just to see it as a job you do. You efficiently put the person off to sleep and wake them up in the end and bring the next one in, and we're a facilitator. Like, very few people knock on the door and say, "Oh, can you give me an anaesthetic, please?" They come they've come to have some problem fixed, some operation or whatever, and our job is to make that as safe and take away as much of the unpleasantness of that experience as possible. And so, yeah, we're kind of used to flying under the radar, and and here you are saying, no, we should all be thinking more about this. This is an interesting thing.
I think it is, because I do think, I mean, there's different temperaments and, you know, some people obviously information that makes them anxious. But I think one of the things that really struck me, especially sort of reading some of those studies about, you know, there've been various, I mean, apart from the Hank Bennett one, there've been various studies looking at, you know, hospitals where they've given sort of quite short 5 minutes sort of semi-hypnotic suggestions before surgery. And there was one out of New York a few years ago. And basically, they suggested that patients, should go in and that they should feel less pain and not lose less blood, but, you know, vomit less and generally do better. And those patients, compared to the control group, they came out quicker, they used considerably less drugs, they recovered better, and they saved the hospital, on average, $700 per patient. Mm. And the person who had written the study, or in fact someone who was writing an editorial on the study, said, if someone had developed a drug that would do this, everyone would be buying it. Why don't we do it?
I've never tried. I'm not a very hypnotisable person myself.
But they said it didn't matter. They did it. It didn't matter, where they were on the left. Because it wasn't. They weren't. They're like,
still doing
they weren't
it
like
in that institution.
Hypnotised. It was just the suggestions. It wasn't. I don't know. I should go back and.
That's
but it was
for
very quick.
Look, we're going to wrap up soon, but just before we do, Tim, can I ask you, when you heard Kate on the radio, why were you so enthusiastic about this discussion taking place?
Well, I'd read an excerpt in the newspaper of the book and then heard you on the radio, and I was just really impressed that... first of all, I'm envious because you've met all the famous anaesthetists all around the world, having pushed yourself upon them or whatever. and secondly, I just thought you had a knack for putting it in a way that the general public could get, and I just thought you really did get it in a way that most journalists probably don't. So,
Oh, thank you, even though it's still completely bewildering to me. But, you know...
And Kate, finally, we've heard a bit about how anaesthetists have responded to the book. What about people who have gone under general anaesthetic? What stories have they shared with you?
Look, I've had a lot of... I mean, weirdly, just about every interview, I mean, every time anyone has interviewed me, they've stopped halfway through or often at the end after we're off air and said, oh, I had this really weird experience. So lots of people tell me about waking up, and most of the time it's not a problem. This one woman who I met, and she told me this story about going into surgery, and the surgeon was a woman, and she was wearing a string of pearls, and during the surgery the pearls broke. And so the woman who was telling me this story said that the next day when she was, you know, the surgeon came around the next day and said, how are you feeling? And she said...
Can I have my pearls back?
Well, she said... No. The surgeon who'd been wearing the pearls said, how are you feeling? And the patient said, I'm fine, but I hope you didn't leave any of those pearls inside me. And the surgeon went completely white and said, you weren't meant to hear that conversation. You weren't... How do you know about that? So I've heard lots of stories like that. I've also had a couple of... a few people contact me with very, very sad stories. Much more people with kind of weird, interesting, slightly odd or slightly disturbing stories, but a few very sad stories about people who had terrible experiences. And, you know, I think even 20 years ago, the profession was much less open to talking about or even acknowledging this sort of trauma. And so I think a lot of people got doubly traumatised because, first of all, something terrible happened and then it was denied. So, but, a lot of... And all the people who hate it haven't told me. So that's good.
Well, Kate, thank you so much for starting this fascinating and important conversation. Can you please join me in thanking our wonderful guests, Kate Cole Adams and Dr. Tim McCullough.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Center podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercenter.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.